like. No, no, this is finished. This is. My dears, I am tired of my own pyrotechnics, so I can imagine you must be exhausted by them, really. It's a good thing that it doesn't take this long to read every single sentence of Shoghi Effendi. You know, somebody said to me yesterday, you spent 1 hour on one sentence? And I started calculating. I thought, good grief, if it takes a week, 6 days, to read 6 sentences of Shoghi Effendi, how many weeks, months, years, decades, epochs, cycles will it take before we read, for example, the Dispensation of Baha'u'llah? But you should have read it before next year, you know. So on the one hand, certainly 1 hour is not enough to spend on a single sentence of Shoghi Effendi. I was calculating for myself that it took me several epochs, at least, to understand 2 or 3 of the sentences of Shoghi Effendi. I've just begun. The light was first diffused across the surface of my intellect. It took several more decades before it sort of began to penetrate into my conscience. And it's only now, at the decrepit age that I have achieved, which you know about, that it's finally beginning to suffuse me and make me realize I have to change my life. Just sentence by sentence. I mentioned yesterday that Shoghi Effendi is giving us music. And we have before us today one of those musical themes that is so familiar. When you become acquainted and familiarized with the writings of Shoghi Effendi, you begin to attune your ears to his music. And you know what I mean when I say, ah, there it is again. That's the Shoghi Effendi however theme. That's the no matter what theme. That's the music of whatever may happen theme. Do you remember we did that music last year as well? Those of you that weren't with us, let's just recall, just so that we can begin to hear that music throbbing through our veins. Let's remember the last of the sentences that I did with you in Akuto 2004. Remember it began, whatever may befall this infant faith of God. Do you remember that thing that you have on the 3 pages? Do try to pull it out so we can look at it again together. Whatever may befall this infant faith of God, in future decades or in succeeding centuries, whatever the sorrows, dangers, and tribulations which the next stage in its worldwide development may engender, from whatever quarter the assaults to be launched by its present or future adversaries may be unleashed against it, however great the reverses and setbacks it may suffer, we, who have been privileged to apprehend to the degree our finite minds can fathom the significance of these marvelous phenomena associated with its rise and development, establishment, can harbour no doubt that what it has already achieved in the first 100 years of its life provides sufficient guarantee that it will continue to forge ahead, capturing loftier heights, tearing down every obstacle, opening up new horizons, and winning still mightier victories until its glorious mission, stretching into the dim ranges of time that lie ahead, is totally fulfilled. Shoghi Effendi begins that sentence with that same theme. You remember? I said to you yesterday, I wasn't sure whether it was a cello or an oboe. It has a kind of plangency about it. Do you know that word? Plangency. It sort of plucks your heartstrings. Listen to those first lines of the last sentence I read just now. Whatever may befall this infant faith of God in future decades or in succeeding centuries, whatever the sorrows, dangers, and tribulations which the next stage of its worldwide development may engender, from whatever quarter the assaults to be launched by its present or future adversaries may be unleashed against it, however great the reverses. All of that put together is basically saying, no matter what, no excuses. He does that over and over again. In this one, it was whatever may befall, and it had a beautiful rhythm that catches you. In another one, which I just quickly quote to you, which is quoted in Citadel of Faith, page 50, appeal to members of the community so privileged, so loved, so valorous, endowed with such potentialities, to unitedly press forward. Now listen, here it comes again, the oboe, the cello theme. However afflictive the trials their countrymen may yet experience, however grievous the tribulations the land of their heart's desire may yet suffer, however oppressive an anxiety the temporary severance of external communications with the world centre of their faith may engender, however onerous the tasks still to be accomplished. Now we could spend an hour on every single one of those howevers, because there is so much in them. There is prophecy in them, there is warning in them, there is caution in them, there is assurance in them, there is encouragement in them, there is an admission of this incredible, compassionate, true brother who knows how weak we are, how inadequate we are, how much we are afraid. And it's the knowledge of all that Shoghi Effendi knows about ourselves and about the society in which we are that we find packed into these howevers. Now, the one that I've given you today starts not with whatever may befall, not with however, but with no matter how long. Now, he goes into the howevers after that. But he begins with a no matter how long. Because I think it's befitting that at the end of a long and yet too short week, we start with a reflection again on the perspective of time that Shoghi Effendi gives us. I will read this sentence to you and then we'll go through it more closely. No matter how long the period that separates them from ultimate victory. Sorry, before we read one word further, let's remember this was a message which is collected in the Messages to the Baha'i World, as you can see, page 38. It comes very early in that book, messages written between 1950 and 1957. This was the letter that Shoghi Effendi released to the world just before the opening of the 10-year crusade. It's like a call of warning in anticipation. Before he even tells us that this is the 10-year crusade that we're about to enter, he warns us and he makes a condition with us. This is a contract. He asks us to sign in blood, to seal with our promise, something before he even gives us what the 10-year crusade is. We have to promise something to him. It's a very interesting thing, because you know in the hidden words, it's love me that I may love thee. We have to be prepared to be prepared. And in this letter of Shoghi Effendi, as you can hear the words, remember that we don't even yet know that this is the 10-year crusade we're launching into. And before even he gives us the 10-year crusade, he is telling us, no matter how long the period that separates them from ultimate victory, however arduous the task, however formidable the exertions demanded of them, however dark the days, which mankind, perplexed and sorely tried, must in its hour of travail traverse. However severe the tests with which they who are to redeem its fortunes will be confronted, however afflictive the darts which their present enemies, as well as those whom Providence will, through his mysterious dispensations, raise up from within or from without, may rain upon them, however grievous the ordeal of temporary separation from the heart and nerve center of their faith, which future unforeseeable disturbances may impose upon them, I adjure them, by the precious blood that flowed in such great profusion, by the lives of the unnumbered saints and heroes who were immolated, by the supreme, the glorious sacrifice of the prophet herald of our faith, by the tribulations which its founder himself willingly underwent, so that his cause might live, his order might redeem a shattered world, and its glory might suffuse the entire planet, I adjure them, as this solemn hour draws nigh, to resolve never to flinch, never to hesitate, never to relax, until each and every objective in the plans has been fully consummated. Well, that's our first reading. And where is the main sentence? What is all this about, really? As I said, Shoghi Effendi is asking us to make a contract with him. That's really what it boils down to. The main sentence is very, very short in this long sentence. I've given you several words in addition, and I could have added further from those words right down to the bottom, but the real core of that sentence are three words that are repeated twice. I adjure them. And he says it again. I adjure them. And if you want to really expand it, you can say, I adjure them to resolve. And if you want to understand completely all the ramifications of that main sentence, what it is, I adjure them to resolve never to flinch, never to hesitate, never to relax. Three nevers. That sums it up. That's all there is at the core of the sentence. I adjure them. Now, what does that word mean, adjure? You know, before we even get to the word adjure, I thought I'd stop with the very first word in that main sentence, I. Everything that we have heard about Shoghi Effendi, everything we have read about him, everything we have felt subconsciously about him from his writings, has told us repeatedly of his modesty, his humility. How rarely Shoghi Effendi chose to use the personal pronoun I. I made a little summary collection of the places where I found him saying I in some of his letters. And I'll just read a few of those to you. He starts off using I simply to encourage us. At least I started off introducing you to that use of his use of I. Listen to it. With a glad and grateful heart, I welcome. I hail. That's another way of saying welcome. With feelings of thankfulness and relief. With a heart overflowing with joy and thankfulness, I acclaim. I am overjoyed to announce. I am overjoyed to share. I feel impelled on this historic occasion. I invite his followers. Then he also uses I to remind us not just of the moment of encouragement, the moment of importance. He uses it for the past. I recall, he says. With a throbbing heart, I call to mind. I look back with feelings of wonder, thankfulness, and joy. I can but at this juncture touch upon. I am particularly reminded. I have been impelled to transmit, nor can I fail to acclaim. Now let's look at what he says about this moment, how he uses the word I to emphasize the present. I feel the hour is now ripe, he says. I call upon, I urge, moreover. I earnestly appeal. Furthermore, I cannot too strongly emphasize. I entreat them. Finally, I direct my appeal. It is indeed my fervent and constant prayer. I direct my fervent plea. I am ardently hoping, fervently supplicating. Now in this sentence, I adjure them. It's something even beyond supplicate, even beyond appeal, even beyond urge, even beyond emphasize, beyond all these other words I call upon, my fervent plea. It's beyond all of those. I looked up this word for you and I found a whole pile of things which start very gently from the word ask. I ask them. I invite them. I request them. I urge, press, entreat, implore them. I beseech, beg, plead. I pray, invocate, call upon, cry out. I go on bended knees to them. I fall before them, call for help from them. I protest to them, declare, testify, attest, affirm. I swear to them. I place them under oath. I call heaven to witness. Well, we are them, just in case you thought you were going to get off lightly from this story. Them are not these great heroes of the 10-year crusade, nor are they just the people who happened to be born during those 10 years and were participating in some fumbling fashion. These words are written to the past and to the future. And the whole of the first part of this sentence, starting from no matter how long, going all the way down. And I made a mistake. In fact, I should have started a new line. I did have space on this page. Do you see where it says on the fourth line, however dark the days? It would be really good to put a new line after that, which mankind, perplexed and sorely tried, must in its hour of travail traverse. It would be helpful just for the rhythm. I'll read it to you and you'll understand why. No matter how long the period that separates them from ultimate victory, however arduous the task, however formidable the exertions demanded of them, however dark the days, which mankind, perplexed and sorely tried, must in its hour of travail traverse, however severe the tests with which they who are to redeem its fortunes will be confronted, however afflictive the darts which their present enemies, as well as those whom Providence will, through his mysterious dispensations, raise up from within or from without, may rain upon them, however grievous the ordeal of temporary separation from the heart and nerve centre of their faith, which future unforeseen disturbances may impose upon them. How many howevers are there? Are you sure? Seven. There are seven. Or implied howevers. No matter how is like however. No matter how long, that's time. It doesn't matter how long it's going to take. Now, we heard in the course of this magnificent week about the goals of the 10-year plan, and we know that the House of Justice has still got plans, the goals from the 10-year crusade, which it has taken to its heart and will continue to wait for their fulfillment. It is still committed to the charter of the 10-year crusade, to the promise, the signature on oath before heaven that we signed in accepting that 10-year crusade from Shoghi Effendi. We are under oath to complete those goals. And there are still many that haven't been completed. I won't go through them now because we've gone through them before, but in your summary and your reassessment of all our work this week, to realize that even you, in your lifetimes, may be privileged to participate in the fulfillment of those goals, however long the period that separates them from ultimate victory. So, in terms of time, this stretches right up to us. We are the them. And our children and our children's children and those to whom we haven't yet mentioned the faith but who are waiting to hear about the cause of Baha'u'llah, those are the them that are waiting to participate in the ultimate victory of this plan and all the plans of the House of Justice. So the first, however or no matter, is about time. However arduous the task. Now the word arduous, quite simply and plain flat Anglo-Saxon, means hard, aardvark. I don't know what an aardvark is, but it must be very hard to eat ants. You know, isn't that what an aardvark is? Doesn't it eat ants? Right, it's an anteater, isn't it? An aardvark. I always thought that word symbolized how hard it was, you know, ant by ant. That's how you fill your stomach. Anyway, however arduous, it means however difficult the task. However formidable the exertions demanded of them. Now the word formidable, when you say something is formidable, it means it overwhelms you. You say, oh my goodness, I can't do this. This is a formidable problem. This is enormous. It has dimensions beyond anything that I can encompass in my mind or my capacities. Something formidable, you talk about a formidable enemy. You're not capable of facing such a formidable challenge. In this case, however formidable, it's the exertions demanded of them. That means the however here is directed to our efforts. However much we must make effort. Excuse me.
You have to see me with my bottle.
to assure you, is no longer French water. This comes from a Akuto tap. And I shock everybody and appall the world by drinking from the bottle. Excuse me. Sorry. However formidable the exertions demanded of them, in other words, no matter how challenging, how overwhelming the amount of effort you have to exert, the amount of energy you have to put into the task, okay? That's very different from the difficulty. For some people, a task may be difficult, but they don't have to put so much effort into it. For others, a task which seems to one person to be easy may demand enormous effort from the other one. So this is a question he's touching very closely to our pulse here. He's getting very close to each individual fibre of our response here. Everything is relative here. If it's difficult for you, that's because you have to exert effort, your personal effort. And he's saying no matter how much effort you have to make, not only how long, not only how difficult, but also how much effort, how much energy you have to expend, you have to exert. However dark the days. This is one which always makes me tremble. Because do remember, in glancing at your chronology, look at what Shoghi Effendi achieved in some of the darkest days of the 20th century. I haven't lingered too much on those, on that chronology, because I trusted that you would look at it in your own time. But it's really remarkable to think of what he did in some of the darkest times. He gave us the most extraordinary words of encouragement, of illumination, of an understanding of the faith at a time when the world around him was crumbling, where bombs were flying over the master's house in Haifa, to say nothing of the personal dangers that he had to face when he was in Europe and the challenges of his actually getting back to the world centre. You must have read in Priceless Pearl the stories of some of those afflictive years in the very early years of the Second World War, which was a time so prolific for him that he actually completed God Passes By at that very period. So however dark the days, you know, when many people tell us, oh, you really ought to do something, you very often say, well, it's all right for them to talk, you know. But in this case, we can't say that. Shoghi Effendi is telling us that because he's experienced it. He knows how dark the days can be. If he were here amongst us now, I dare swear he would use these very words to encourage us to go back to our communities and face truly the bewilderment that we find in all of our countries, where mankind, perplexed and sorely tried, is traversing in its hour of travail. Now the words travail, traverse, have been wonderfully juxtaposed in this particular phrase. However dark the days which mankind, little phrase there, perplexed and sorely tried, must in its hour of travail traverse. The word travail is a wonderful word. It means not just work, it means labor. And again, we go back to that extraordinary metaphor from the feminine body of going into labor to give birth. It's called the pains of your travail. It's a period of laboring of the body to allow the child to go through those convulsions, the body to go through its contractions in order to release the baby into the world. Those are the hours of the meaning of the word travail, all right? So he's saying that in this hour of travail, which is where we are, this birth hour, this moment when we're giving birth to a new world civilization, mankind is passing through dark days and must traverse them, cross them, So he's using the word travail, traverse. You have to get through it. There's one thing you can be absolutely sure when you've got a baby is that it's going to come out. You can't stop it, you know. You can kind of kid yourself for 9 months that it's just, you know, indigestion. There will come a moment when you have to face the reckoning. It's not indigestion, nor is it some kind of ghastly disease. It's actually a baby, and it's coming out. And there's nothing you can do to stop it. You have to go through that. Now, you can go kicking and screaming. You can go in denial. I've often thought that the world around us is like a woman who's been pregnant for quite a long while now. Only nobody told her she had a baby. First, she really thought she was sick, you know, for 3 months. Then she thought she was getting really fat. She tried to diet. She tried to sort of make up for it. Sort of got worse and worse. Her ankles began to swell. She began to think she was hallucinating. What is this? And then the pains began. Now, that's where we are now. Now, if you can imagine, if it's possible to imagine a woman who doesn't know that she's in labor, can you imagine what's going on in her head? I'm possessed. I've got devils in me. Somebody help me. Get rid of this thing. I'm dying. That's what you must feel if you don't know that a baby's coming out. Or you can feel, stop this. Anybody, come here, stop this. I don't want this to go on. Somebody has to do something to save me and stop this. There's only one way out, and that is to let the baby be born. There's only one way out, is to be illumined with the understanding. First, diffuse the idea. Psst, by the way, you've been pregnant. Let the information penetrate. Ooh. Let it suffuse through the understanding and comprehending of this mind. Oh my goodness me. Of course, we are far beyond such ignorances, but it just helps us understand the condition of the world in which we are. It helps us realize why it is that in this time of sore perplexity, in this time of being so tried, that means being tested, suffering, we feel that it is impossible. The depression, it's just too difficult to get through this. I want to just stress the differences in these howevers. There's the however of time, there's the however of difficulty, there's the however of effort and energy that we must exert, and there is also this however of suffering, pain, bewilderment. These are implicit in this fourth, however dark the days, which mankind, perplexed means confused, bewildered, and sorely tried, must in its hour of travail traverse. It must traverse. That's the verb there in that subordinate clause. And then, however severe the tests with which they who are to redeem its fortunes will be confronted. Now, Mr. Nashavani this morning was reminding us that there are different kinds of tests. There are those that come as a result of our own folly that we bring upon ourselves. There are those that come for the betterment, for the improvement, for the development of our spiritual lives, for the burnishing and purification of the dross of the self, for the creation of gold out of our souls. Now, if we are going through a perplexity because we don't know we're pregnant, in that first kind of suffering and the however that I just read you, frankly, just between you and me, it's our own fault, isn't it? We've had a voice that is for over a century has been calling us to God. We've had a chance already to know that this is the moment of giving birth to a new civilization. If the world is perplexed and sore tried and is screaming and fretting and terrified by all the blood and in shock, it's because we have not listened to the voice of God that has been calling us to to a reckoning that has been reminding us that this is the age of fulfillment. That is a test, in other words, that has been the result of our own folly. I don't think that there is a single woman on this planet that is as stupid as mankind today in our not understanding that this is the hour of giving birth. Women at least know when they're pregnant. So humanity and the tests that it's been going through, that kind of a test in that first, however, that I just read before, however dark the days, this is the kind of test which is perhaps as a result of our own folly, our own resistance, our own inadequate response to the message of Baha'u'llah. However, the other, however, that comes immediately after, however severe the tests, I have a hunch Shoghi Effendi is suggesting there that these are the two kinds of suffering. There is the suffering due to our own folly. There is the suffering which is a test, which is for our improvement, which is for our strengthening, which is to prove that we are made of the pure metal. It is a test which they who are to redeem its fortunes will be confronted. This is to test us so that we become those who are capable of redeeming the fortunes of the faith. Now, the word redeem is a powerful word there. We have used this word in other revelations, in other dispensations. We have known that manifestations of God have come to redeem us. It's a word that means save, doesn't it? Now, in this case, it's not being directed to the prophets of God. This is us. This is them who is us. We are going to be called upon to save the fortunes of this faith, to leap into the fray, to stand up in defense of the cause, to redeem its name, to speak up on behalf of our blessed House of Justice and say, this is what this institution is. This is where it derives its authority. This is why and how, through the charters of the Will and Testament and so forth. We have to be able to be strong enough to stand and face those tests. Confront means to be faced by. So he has moved out of one kind of, however dark, to another kind of inner test, a spiritual test, which is also a testing of our ability to defend the faith from those who attack it, and that therefore prepares us for the next, however afflictive the darts which their present enemies, as well as those whom Providence will through his mysterious dispensations raise up from within or from without, may rain upon them. This was such a difficult clause that I decided we needed to spend a bit of time on it to understand it. Did you all get confused reading that? Look at how confusing it could be. However afflictive the darts which their present enemies, as well as those whom Providence, will, through his mysterious dispensations raise up from within or from without, may? Are you lost? Very confusing, isn't it? May rain upon them. At the point, by the time I get to them here, I'm not sure whether I'm talking about enemies or me. When I got to his, I was already confused. I was thinking, is that Providence or what? I couldn't see where the subject of the verb may rain upon them came from. When I was with a subject, however afflictive the darts which their present enemies, I got so lost in everything else that happened, I forgot where the verb was. So this is something that maybe we could spend a bit of time on. However afflictive the darts. Now, I would suggest that you rewrite this phrase in your own words in the space down below so that you can see the relationship of words to words. However afflictive the darts. And then below darts, start writing the next phrase, which their present enemies may rain upon them. That's how that particular adjectival clause qualifying the word dart works. Okay? However afflictive the darts, question mark, which darts? The darts are those which their present enemies jump may rain upon them. That is your complete adjectival clause. So what is all the rest of it? What's happening with all the rest of it in the middle there? However afflictive the darts, which their present enemies, as well as those whom providence will... Wait a minute. As well as those whom providence... We don't get to will yet. We comma, right? We get to the comma there. As well as those whom providence, comma, will, comma, through his mysterious dispensations, raise up from within as well as from without. Now, if we want to really make it easy for ourselves, we will do this. As well as those whom providence will raise up from within as well as from without. Okay? Now, the reason there isn't a comma there is for that purpose. If you look at the actual sentence on the page, as well as those whom providence will, the comma there is allowing you to get back to raise. Okay? Will raise up from within or from without. That's how it goes. And you need the comma there because you need to make a little parenthesis. Will, through his mysterious dispensations, raise up. Okay? He doesn't allow us to breathe between dispensations and raise up. He doesn't allow us to breathe there. He doesn't give us a comma there. He wants that sentence to push through, that phrase to push through. So it goes, as well as those whom providence will, through his mysterious dispensations, raise up from within or from without, may rain upon them. There is a certain pacing in language. You have to be very acute to the question of punctuation. And why Shoghi Effendi doesn't use punctuation there is because, boy oh boy, are those enemies from within and from without going to come hurtling upon us. There's going to be no pause. They're not going to say politely, excuse us, we're about to rain some darts upon you. Just as we're trying to figure out the grammar, they're already raining the darts. We have to be prepared to be prepared. And the reason this sentence is convoluted, this phrase is convoluted, is to force upon us the importance of understanding just where the darts are coming from. So that we don't stand around saying, whoops, there's a dart. We know we've got the focus. They're going to come from within. What does that mean? From within the faith as well as from without. These are enemies who are not just recognizable characters with turbans on their heads. Nice little cartoon enemies. These are enemies that are on every level from within and from without. Just from a purely psychological point of view, these are our own doubts. These are our own questionings which do not go back to the writings to ascertain the truth, but dwell on themselves and brood on themselves and caress themselves and pump themselves up with their little egos. Oh, aren't I clever to have such doubts? The enemies from within are not only within the faith, but within all of us. These are enemies that we have to recognize. This is what Mr. Nachavani was saying. This is the insistent ego. Now, we'll get to this a little bit lower down, because we'll really have him identify what some of them are when we get to those nevers. Never, 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 never. We'll begin to understand who those ego enemies are from within. But this is, of course, an indication of the other kinds of enemies, which, if you remember, the reason we're all gathered together in Akuto is to strengthen our knowledge of the faith, our grasp of the administrative order, our understanding of the covenant, in order to be able to understand how to defend the faith from its enemies, from within and from without. So the concept of enemies here, you have to be able to bear in mind, is on several levels. And he is saying in this, however afflictive the darts.
Now the word dart is not just something you throw in a pub into a centre of concentric rings, you know, while you're having your beer. You know what I mean by dart? That's not the kind of dart Shoghi Effendi's talking about. He's using the word dart in the classic sense to mean arrow. That's what it means. It means that sharp, unbearable ch-ding that penetrates the skin and actually may not go that much further. But boy, oh boy, does it hurt. It's not like a bomb in your face. Because frankly, nothing can undermine this cause and its foundation. All the enemies of the faith will ever be able to do is to throw a shower of darts at us. And are we going to stand around going, ouch, ooh, is that what we're supposed to be doing? This is nothing. These are flies. They're just darts. We have to be able to endure such darts. They just go skin deep. Sometimes if we allow them to fester, we could get gangrene. We have to pull them out, say, oh, that's a dart, is it? He's using these words on the one hand to recognize, to help us recognize the relative severity of some of these howevers. They are severe. Oh, goodness me, don't tell me. I haven't even got to the other part. Right, we go through all the rest. Jump to, I adjure them. I would like to remind you of that ordeal of temporary separation from the heart and nerve center. This is truly prophetic because this certainly is what has happened to many of the friends in the Muslim countries of the world who have been cut off from the world center of the faith. Maybe not during the 10-year crusade, but certainly subsequent to it. And I remember during the Congress, in fact, it was during the 10-year crusade in Iraq, was it not? There were people imprisoned during the 10-year crusade in Iraq. And I remember there was a moment, a very moving moment, when there was an acknowledgement of that fact during that wonderful World Congress. But let's go now straight on to what else he's doing in this sentence. Because quite apart from all the however, which is telling us all the difficulties that we know we have, the weaknesses that we know we've experienced, the problems that confront us and will confront us in the future, then, with that first, I adjure them, he comes to the grounds of his beseeching. Now, when you read the prayers and meditations of Baha'u'llah, you very often find this pattern in the prose of Baha'u'llah's prayers, which has been beautifully translated by Shoghi Effendi in the term, I beseech thee by thy name this, by the this and that. These are the, you vow, you swear by something. You're calling heaven to witness, remember, in that word adjure. And look at how Shoghi Effendi, who he calls up to bear witness to our promise to him. He's calling up all the martyrs, the precious blood that flowed in such great profusion, by the lives, not just the deaths, by the lives of the unnumbered saints and heroes who were immolated. Now that word immolate means crushed, destroyed, rendered null and void. It can mean many kinds of immolation. It can mean many kinds of death besides the physical death. It includes the physical death. By the precious blood that flowed in such great profusion, by the lives of the unnumbered saints, all the heroes and martyrs that were immolated, by, now he's going step by step up, by the supreme, the glorious sacrifice of the prophet herald of our faith. He has reached back into the heroic age. He has looked forward into the formative age, and now he is looking back to the heroic age, and he is recalling the martyrdom of the Bab himself, and by the tribulations which its founder, Baha'u'llah, himself willingly underwent. Now look at the way he piles it up. It's not just the tribulations set against the sacrifice, set against the immolation, set against the blood that flowed. When Baha'u'llah is brought into this equation, by the tribulations which its founder himself underwent, so that his cause might live, his order might redeem a shattered world, and its glory might suffuse the entire planet. Those three implied so that, the purpose for which Baha'u'llah himself willingly underwent his tribulations, sum up really the three ages. He underwent tribulations so that his cause might live. That's really, I found myself thinking of the heroic age. You remember what happened in Baghdad when Baha'u'llah was exiled finally out of the Siyar Char and arrived in Baghdad. For those few first years, the cause of the Bab would have died. Its future was in peril had it not been for the arrival of Baha'u'llah there. He made the cause live. He took that ignition of the light from the Siyar Char and set ablaze the community of the Babis in Baghdad. So that concept of the heroic age really comes to a climax there, that his order, now we come to the world order, might redeem a shattered world. We've moved from the heroic to the formative age, it seems to me, because there we're beginning to build up from the rubble of bricks of a destroyed order, a new order in its stead, as Baha'u'llah has said. The formative age is the process of building up those institutions that its glory might suffuse the entire planet. That's surely the golden age. And he takes us all the way through. He adjures us by the past that brings us right up to the present and into the future. And he repeats it, I adjure them. As this solemn hour draws nigh, now we come to those to resolve, never to flinch. I'm really sorry that I've left myself only with 5 minutes to talk about this extraordinary ending of the sentence. To resolve, never to flinch, never to hesitate, never to relax. You know, it's extraordinary from a purely literary point of view, looking at the way in which words are set up on the page, to put so much emphasis at the end of such a powerful build-up on negatives. Anyone who is doing journalism or studying writing of any kind will be told by writers, by their teachers, don't emphasize it through the negative, you know. Especially those of us who are in the media and who've got 3 or 5 sound bites to be able to say anything. The only thing you're allowed to say is, I'm great. You know, you have to say something positive about yourself. That's what presidential campaigns are about. Vote for me. I'm the best. That's all you've got time for. You can't spend time saying, don't vote for the other guy. You just say, look at me, I'm the greatest. Okay? If they give you a few more sound bites, you can say, don't vote for them. But you're never allowed to say, don't hesitate about voting for me. Don't have any doubts about voting for me. Don't for a moment ponder over the possibility that there may be something that don't. There's no time, is there? It's vote for me or no one. That's all you have time for in our modern form of communication. Now, Shoghi Effendi is building up all of this to tell us what not to do. This is really quite extraordinary. He's telling us to resolve, which is an extremely constructive word. That means to decide, to take command over our lives and our decision-making powers. To resolve, never to flinch, never to hesitate, never to relax. Now, what does flinch mean? Flitch is one of those wonderful Anglo-Saxon words again. I keep telling you, they come back to single syllable sounds, Anglo-Saxon in English. Just it's either flitch or mud, remember? Flinch is what you do when the darts come. There's a dart coming at you, there's an arrow coming at you. What do? It's your instinct. You go, flinch is just even a twitch of the facial muscles. You go, it's even more invisible than that. It's a moment of tremble in your conscience. You say, oh no. Oh no, they've appointed me to that committee. You say, oh no, I have to stand up and say something in a cruto. Of course, I have to do it, right? I have to do it. But you've had the moment of... The word flinch is invisible. It's a tiny little instinct of the muscles. We're not even in control of it. It happens in spite of ourselves. We could run back to Shoghi Effendi and say, you know, you can't ask me not to flinch. Yeah. I mean, my body is set up to flinch. If you didn't want me to flinch, you should have told God not to make me in such a way that my instinct is to flinch. It's normal that I flinch. He is saying, never to flinch. However hard it is, however long it takes, however difficult it is, however much you have to put your effort into it, however many darts come, resolve never to flinch. I adjure them to resolve never to flinch. Quite something. You're not just sort of in a private room saying, yeah, okay, Shoghi Effendi, I will flinch. And then you flinch. You've got all these martyrs standing there to witness you. You've got all these heroes. Mullah Hussein and Qudus range their rank upon rank. You've got Martha Root and all these other shining people who never flinched. How the heck they did it, I don't know. They're all there. They're coming to the room to bear witness to your signature on this contract. They're saying, are you going to sign? Are you going to resolve? And as if that wasn't enough, you've got the Bab coming in. You've got Baha'u'llah standing there watching you. You'd better never flinch. You see what happens to you when you begin to realize what is going on in the sentence. You resolve never to flinch. Never to hesitate. Never to relax. I think I better stop. Right. Until each and every objective, has been fully consummated. I don't think that I have fully consummated any of the objectives of these sentences of Shoghi Effendi. I would ask you, at the end of this Akuto year, in preparation of what we must do next year, to resolve in his name and with him as witness that you will spend this year studying everything in this wonderful book. Has everybody now got this book, which has been given to you as a gift by the National Assembly of Italy? 10 euros, nothing. You wait till you find out what the NSAs of your countries are going to have to pay for it. Have you all got a copy? Is there anyone who doesn't? Resolve to read that cover from cover to cover. Resolve to read everything that you have been given this year already by Mr. Nakhchivani, cover to cover. Resolve to make it your own, to give it back to your communities in forms that are appropriate, and to come back next year prepared for something unbelievable, to read his language together again.